Once upon a time, on Mother's Day, Natasha El-Skari hosted a storytelling event called Listen to Your Mother. And her own story started this way.
I was the little girl who never dreamed of her marriage and never dreamed nor wondered if she would have children.
Babysitting confirmed for her that kids just steal your time away. Of course, she wouldn't be telling stories as a mother if something hadn't changed.
It makes total sense that I would fall in love in college with a graduate student who wanted nothing more than to be married and have six children.
For reasons of love and other reasons all her own, she did have kids, but she has always been very clear about the feminist upbringing they would receive. And for Natasha, that has meant a lot of things, including what she wants for her kids. Money's fine, career, fine, but that's not what she's raising them to achieve.
I want three things for my children. I want them to be happy, educated, and have the greatest sense of social justice that they could possibly become the most irritating person at a social event of any kind.
That recording is from a few years ago, but Natasha is still raising her kids according to feminism. With the sun off at college, she's out with a new book, Mama Sutra, Love and Lovemaking Advice for My Son. A provocative title, but that's fitting because this book is really a guide for dismantling patriarchy in everyday life. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Natasha El-Skari is the subject of today's portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. She's a writer, artist, educator, and champion of social justice. She runs a gallery. She started a grocery store on wheels. She's the kind of person who seems to be everywhere all at once. And we're going to find out what makes her tick. Natasha El-Skari, good morning.
Good morning.
This book, Mama Sutra, was actually something your son requested during a conversation the two of you were having on his birthday. It's a story you tell in the book's introduction. Can you tell it now?
Right, absolutely. So my son and I were having our birthday conversation, which of course now is not face-to-face because he's away at college. And our conversation naturally steered into sex. And, he said, Mom, I really think that you should write a book about all of our hilarious and wonderful conversations, because I am seeing that I really deeply feel like my friends and people I know and people I go to school with have not really had these conversations with their parents. And it was mind-blowing for him because, you know, the only experience you have is your own. And it's not until you go to college that you realize everybody wasn't raised like me. Everybody didn't have the same upbringing. And I think regardless of how socially conscious we try to, you know, teach our children to be, they're only going to have their singular experience. And he said, I really think that people could benefit from this book because, you know, when I talk to women and when I talk to men in my age group, we are having very different conversations about
the women as opposed to the men.
Yes, the women as opposed to the men, even, with how a date went or, you know, if they like each other, you know. Or even possibly what happened after a sexual experience, right? It's like it's a very different, you know, and because he is a great listener, he gets to hear all of this information. And yeah.
I love what you remember him saying to you. He said, you need to write a book and call it the Mama Sutra. You can thank me later.
Yes, he did. He isn't a big idea guy, right? And so, and I said, Nazir, that is such a great idea. And I was like, Mama Sutra? He says, yeah, Mom, that's just who you are. And when he hits like that, I just go with it. Like, I always know that feeling of when I should say yes. It's something I've always been interested in, but of course, just, you know, life and living it. And I would jot down notes here and there. But I think why it's so perfect right now is because I get to share it with him. And I think that is an approach that maybe we haven't seen before. And I think that's what the waiting was about, right? The waiting was, I knew that I wanted to eventually do something like that, but it hadn't really kind of been birthed. In the moment that he said that, I was like, let's do it. You know,
you have a note to the mamas out there, which is also in the introduction. It says, mamas, why abandon your sons now? Presumably you've taken the time to talk about everything under the sun. So why would you cease conversations now? Haven't you taught your sons to pray, clean, cook, handle conflict, grow and love so far? And that really hit home for me. The idea that there's no one better to teach that adult version of self-care and respect for others than a parent, and that it doesn't seem so far-fetched when you put it that way, when you think of all the intimate guidance you give a growing human being up until this point.
Right. And I really want people to get that in the beginning, as to, because of course people kind of, when they first hold the book, or they go, huh? It's always this, what? And then it's, are you the mother? I mean, I get these questions. And then sometimes when I'm talking to young men, I get this blank stare, like looking at me as if I was their mother. Like, how could this be? How could you actually be going there? And then they go, I think this is important, right? And sometimes they may get it. Sometimes they may step away from it, but it has them thinking. And yes, it's true. Like, when I think about all of the things that I had to know about my children in order to be a mother, they're very intimate details. That's probably one of the most difficult parts of being a mother, is how intimately tied you are to your child's life. You know their habits, their ways, their personality, when they're becoming cranky. not even when they're cranky, but even you can hit it at the pass. I mean, it's just all these things you have to know, what they can eat, what's best for them. And so then we get to this part, and then it's like, go ask your dad. And it's like, I don't want to ask him. I want to ask you. Or just this idea that, you know, you love your children so deeply, why wouldn't you want that next thing for them? Why do you want them to have all of this other kind of joy, and then you just expect them to figure it out when it comes to something that really brings the most joy, or should, or can bring the most joy to your life?
When the two of you decided to make this conversation something more than a private conversation, you started talking to a variety of men about just asking them very simply what their moms told them about sex, as well as what they wished their moms had told them about sex. And I do want to say, I feel like there are probably a lot of people who do not want to talk to their moms about sex. But the answers in this book are really fascinating, the answers people gave you.
I think so, particularly because it's from the age of 17 to 70, right? So just the age span, and the idea that many men would have enjoyed their mothers saying something to them, right?
And when they explained why, those who did explain why, it was super fascinating. This one was very simple, but kind of revelatory to me. There was a 37-year-old who told you that his mother told him nothing, and that he didn't care what she had said. He just wished she'd made it more of a normal conversation. And to think that just comfort talking about something comes from the fact that other people weren't closed off about talking to you about it.
Right.
So that would carry into the rest of your life.
Absolutely. And how do you open that conversation with a partner, with a lover, if you've never had it anywhere else, right? That is the most difficult thing to be able to do. It's hard to talk about your vulnerabilities if you've never said, you know, Mom, I'm afraid, or Mom, I'm sad. It's hard to then open up to a lover and say that same thing. And so I believe that mothers have this enormous responsibility to take that parenthood to the next step, right? Just to go a little bit further and open it up as a function of life and having that conversation. The reason that people said, did you really talk to your son about every single thing in this book? And I'm like, yes, because we started talking about it really early. So it wasn't...
Like how early?
Two. Right. Two, three. I tell a story, and all the stories are in there with permission. So there's nothing in the book that my son did not approve of.
He also wrote the introduction.
He did. He did the foreword, and he didn't want to. And I was like, no, you have to. You have to. But there was a moment, you know, when he was younger, where he was dragging himself across everything in the house, and he was nude, you know, and he was just dragging himself. And I said, hey, buddy, what's going on? You know, and he was like, this is so amazing. And I was like, OK, I was like, yeah, I get it. And so he's explaining how amazing it is, you know, and I said, well, that's something special for your room. You can have at it in there, but this is a shared space, so people can't Nobody wants to sit down where you've been dragging yourself, you know. And it was just so light. And he was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And that was it. And so it just opening all of the conversations when his sister was born, he was like, what does she look like? You know, and I had a book already called That's So Amazing. And it's a great book to introduce those kinds of things. But then I just said, well, this is what she looks like. And then he was like, oh, I don't look like that. Okay. And that was it. So it was like, it's just opening this conversation that where people can ask questions, children can ask, like, what does this mean? Or how does this feel? Or, you know, why do you seem so different when you're, you know, when you're like that, you know, all of that. And I think because my son, I was married during that time, we had a lot of affection. So he was accustomed to seeing open affection, right? It wasn't something that was unusual to him. And we have a huge community. So people hug and then they get pregnant and then they have babies. And so they grow up seeing all of this expression. And we talk about it. They know the subtlety of love and what it looks like, or if someone has shifted, or, you know, it's like, ooh, why are they like that now, mom? They're so different. And I'm like, that's what happens. And so I think making love and sex a function of life versus like this taboo thing makes it easy to talk about. It's not something that we have to be afraid to talk about because we're talking about it all the time. And that's why I wrote the book, because I've talked to several people. They say, well, my son doesn't want to talk to me about sex. And I'm like, well, how old is he? And they're like, oh, he's 14. I'm like, well, when was the first time you started talking about sex? And we're like, oh, this year. Well, yeah, that's why. So now I'm already having the feelings. I've already viewed porn. I've already started self-pleasuring. And now all of a sudden my mom is supposed to go, hey, son.
Want to talk about it?
Want to talk about it? He's like, no, I don't, mom. You know, and that's when mothers have to say, okay, well, I do. I want to talk about it, you know, and just really starting the conversation, because it's not too late. Even when they're in their late teens, it's not too late, because they'll still need to ask questions. They'll still need to come back, and maybe it won't be as open initially, but eventually they'll share way more than you ever want to know.
So some listeners might assume this is a sexy book because of the title, but it's something else that's very hard to describe. It's advice and encouragement based on a whole range of things that can enter into intimate relationships, from an understanding of how the human body changes over time and healthy ways of understanding that, to the importance of being able to talk to someone you trust about your relationships, like someone other than the person you're in that relationship with. And then even the nitty gritty of personal hygiene, it is very maternal.
Yes, it is. It really is. And because I feel like those are things that people shouldn't just have to figure out on their own. And the other thing, Gina, is that women talk to each other about all these things. So even if women, if girls are not getting necessarily great advice from their mothers, they typically have like an aunt or another woman that's kind of like a younger hip cousin that they can ask. But they also inquire with each other. And I don't think that men share, by and large, that level of intimacy where they can say to each other, hey, I'm having an issue with this, or have you ever had that? They don't. And so they have a lot of things that go unanswered or not taken care of, or they're walking around thinking certain things are normal or acceptable, and they're not because they're not talking to other people about it, you know. And I think that's the beautiful thing about being a woman, is that we have a level of care and intimacy in our relationships that are different from men. And that is a big reason men walk around kind of clueless about things, is because they don't intimately open up about these things. And
what does this have to do with patriarchy? It's a word that comes up all the time in this book.
It does. It's everywhere. I was like, is it too many places? But patriarchy is everywhere. So that's why I had to address it as such, right? Because we do so many things that are patriarchal that we don't even realize, right? We do these things and we think about these things and we experience and we even perpetuate them as women sometimes that we're not even thinking about. And that is this idea that the way a man is, thinks, or what he needs is above everything else. And that includes even motherhood, right? A woman's job is to be an amazing mother. And then dads get like kudos for taking kids to the park. I mean, people will literally go up to men and say, you're a great dad. Like if he's at the grocery store, you know, whereas it's like, this is the expectation. No one ever comes to a woman and says, you know, the way you picked out that broccoli, I can tell you love your family. But people do that to men. I witnessed that and I experienced that in my own marriage, right? Whereas like the responsibility that a woman has to the marriage and the family and all these things, it's just so much greater. And even down to the intimate details of our bedrooms, right? Or wherever we choose to be intimate, it's that same idea that it's something that the woman needs to be doing, the woman needs to be fixing, the woman needs to be leading for the pleasure of the man. And that is something that really needs to be challenged.
It's so interesting that as someone with a daughter and a son, your wisdom about smashing the patriarchy, at least in this case, is directed to your son.
Right. You know, it's kind of like when all these women get together and they talk about rape. I mean, you know, it's like men. We need to get men together to talk about rape. There are women who rape, but there are way more men. So men benefit from the patriarchy. It's just like race. We can't just talk about racism in oppressed groups. We have to actually talk about racism with white people. So we can't talk about patriarchy and not give some sort of guide to, you know, how to dismantle it. And so that is why it's about, I tell people it's a tool for men, but it's a gift to women. I really feel like this is a gift to women, that if a woman can say, hey, babe, read this, or let's read this together, or I have a gift for you, you know, that is going to help women who are lovers of men, who are going to be intimate with men. That makes a difference.
How do you define patriarchy?
I define patriarchy as the belief that men have rulership over everything and dominion, including a woman's actions, her body, and her mind and spirit, that a man's direction is what guides that, and that it is to his advantage only. It is not to the advantage of the whole.
Race also plays a pretty significant role in this advice you offer. It's right there with body types is something we've been conditioned to see in certain ways that may not be useful or good in real relationships with real people, including ourselves.
Yes, most definitely. And the idea, because race and sexism and class all impact how we view our intimate selves, we have to be able to look at our conditioning. And so that's why I have the contemplations at the end of every section.
These are like workbook areas where you can answer questions about how you think about things and consider ideas that maybe you haven't consciously thought about before.
Yeah, and you get to disagree there, right? It's how you grapple. Because that was one of the things that was really important to Nazir. He said, Mom, I really think that we should approach it as a conversation because people can dip in and out when you get too much for them. So he was like, that is good because it's like you're talking to me and they can keep the advice or throw it away if they don't like that particular section or they don't like something about it. And he was like, but the questions do beg for people to say, like, well, what do I think? And where did I get this information from? Because I think that we just exist in a lot of ways and we don't even think about the impact of how we received our information. Like when you ask people, well, why do you think that? Like, what makes you think that? Even if you go back to what you originally believed, it's still important to know, why am I thinking this way? Does it serve me? Has it benefited me? Has it benefited the people around me to be this way? And if you're going to be an amazing lover, you have to consider that. Are my desires, the desires of my body, is it helpful? Is it to another person? Is it does it feel good to another person? Does it feed another person? Because if it doesn't, you have to be able to have a conversation about that instead of having a partner that's just enduring whatever your behavior is, right? Even if it's one that you think is helpful, it may not be.
You write a lot about Black love and the Black family. What do you mean by those terms?
So obviously, you know, when we think about racism in this country, and, you know, how we survive racism, Black love is one of the ways that we do. I feel like it is very difficult to be in the world where you get beat up every day and then you come home you know, you have to have something to turn to. And intimacy always reminds us of our humanity. And there are so many unspoken things in intimacy, which is what makes it intimacy, because it's like an understanding that you can't always achieve with words or before you can find the words. Sometimes it takes a minute to find the words. And so I do want that. Like, I want that for my children to experience, you know, Black love and Black family. I mean, they have Black family and they've had Black love, but it's just different on an intimate level.
You have this section in the book, Mama Sutra, where you write about the time you fell in love with a white man. And
yeah.
And that's paired with a confession that you didn't have the you love who you love talk with your son because you wouldn't have necessarily meant that.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That is true. I felt like it was important for me to be honest in that is because I'm just one of those people who... I'm just going to reveal it. And I think yeah. I think a lot of people will be surprised to know that. I think a lot of people who know how deeply I feel about the Black family and Black love. But I did. I was, you know, and it was beautiful. And I have zero regrets to it. But it just taught me that it taught me and it teaches me that love is a spiritual thing that transcends all of these social things. But the social things cannot be ignored in a relationship. And I think that is why it was so special with that person, because we didn't have to avoid. We had those tough conversations and we never stopped having those tough conversations. And so I think that is the beautiful part about it. Yeah. But I was very nervous about even sharing that. I'm still nervous. It actually made me nervous when you asked me about it. Yeah.
Can you explain why you write a couple of times that you do hope that your son ultimately finds a Black woman, but you seem to also have some reluctance to, like, you seem to need to also qualify it with, if that's not how it turns out, it's okay, but that's what I want.
Right, because I think you have to do that with any advice you give your children. I mean, really, it's like, I want my kids to get master's degrees, but I'm going to still love them if they don't. Like, I want that. But yes, because I think I do deeply want that for my children. I know what it feels like, but I also know what it feels like to be loved by somebody outside of that. And so...
Well, Natasha Elskari, stay with me through a break, okay? When we return, we will hear about her upbringing, the ups and downs of marriage and divorce, early motherhood and career, loss and grief, and being an advocate for a whole community, because that's the village they're always saying it takes. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with Natasha Elskari, the author of a new book called Mama Sutra. The book is part of a long conversation with her college-age son about relationships and love as he moves into his adult life, and this is a portrait session. We're hearing Natasha's story. Hi, Natasha.
Hi.
Okay, so we have talked so much about raising children, but tell me about your own upbringing.
Ooh. Well, I was born and raised in Kansas City. My parents were married, but they divorced before, or they separated before I was 2 years old. So I don't remember living with my father. I remember just living with my mother and my sister. And so I grew up in what I like to consider like a woman-centered haven, you know?
Did you see the most recent Wonder Woman movie where there's like the island of women?
Right. My daughter, actually, I haven't seen it yet. So I'm not a TV watcher. So my daughter kind of screens things and says, you need to watch this. But I think it went off before I ever got to see it. But everyone is telling me that I need to see it. Yes, I think I did definitely grow up on this island of awesome womanness where everything was clean and food was always there. And you know what I mean? Like, it was safe. The men who entered, you know, were safe. Yeah, my mother was pleasant. She was consistent. She's very shy. My mom is super shy. It comes across as mean sometimes, but I think it's because she's protective and she's a Scorpio. So they just have mean kind of in their, it's kind of interwoven in their being. But yeah, I grew up really, my mother is from a small town in Arkansas, and she came to Kansas City at the age of 17 after she graduated from high school to make a life for herself. And so I grew up with all of my aunts living and uncles living close by. And then also I grew up with my father's family, and they all lived close, not necessarily close to us, but they where they lived was also in a cluster of close. Well, you know, close is different because, of course, in the 70s and 80s, we didn't have 71. So, you know, when you got on the streets, you know, it took a while to get there and, you know, people didn't drive 80 miles an hour.
It wasn't close in time necessarily.
Right, right. But it was still close in proximity. And so I grew up with a ton of first cousins and second cousins and great uncles. I have an enormous family, particularly on my father's side. My mom's side of the family is much smaller.
You know, where in Kansas City did you grow up?
So I grew up off of 75th and Paseo at 7432 Highland. And we had a lot of land next door to our house. So I had a pear tree, a peach tree, a cherry tree. I planted a pecan tree. We had a little basketball court that my father made. And we had a garden. And so we actually... my mom had a garden, and then she rented out some of the land to our next door neighbor who also grew a garden.
So I'm moving in.
Yeah, so it was really cool. I was in a neighborhood of all homeowners, so I grew up in the same house. My mom had the same house until I was 30 years old, and so I have a deep love for that area. You know, that's where my friends grew up, and back then we went to neighborhood schools, and I was in the Southwest cluster, so that meant that our schools were naturally 60-40 because the Southwest cluster included
Explain
Brookside.
60-40.
60% black, 40% white, which was supposed to be always the goal of segregation, right? The desegregation was to kind of make these schools that were, I'm using naturally in quotes, mixed. But that area of town in that during that time was already like that. You know, I grew up with people of, I had, you know, Latinx people on my block. I had people who were biracial, and there were, you know, Jewish people, white people, black people. I mean, it was just a mix of people that were right on our block. Every house was completely different family structures and everything.
Do you remember, just thinking back on your own history, the things you saw, experienced, maybe even things you read really early on that were pivotal in your personal understanding of race in America? Just a small question.
Yeah, I think the earliest, right, just a small, the earliest piece of race that I remember is in my classroom, being a smart black girl and being around other kids and seeing how the teachers and administration responded differently to the white kids versus the black kids. And I understand it differently now. Like I felt,
what was it that you saw?
I felt like my black teachers were really hard on the black kids. And I feel like they were like that because they wanted us to be able to compete. I know that that's what it was, because they weren't mean, but I felt like we were being held to a higher standard in every way, like behavior and how well we did. And I felt like the white kids were easily praised for just, you know, kind of being there. But I have a black mom, so I got it. I think I got it early enough to not feel like I wasn't loved, but I definitely sometimes...
To see it as an expression of love.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely see... It was annoying because sometimes I was like, why does she get away with everything?
Yeah, that sounds super annoying.
Right. I was like, she's bad. And I didn't even say anything. It was because I was very talkative and very free. And I would, you know, and I would be talking to my white friends, but I would be the only one getting in trouble. And I'm like, this is not fair. So I get it now, because those teachers came out of the civil rights movement and everything. And they were like, no, we want you all to be better. You know, we want you to be better, faster, smarter, so you can have these advantages. So
what did you do, though, as that sort of teenage person with that sense of unfairness?
Well, I went to Lincoln, which was also kind of evenly split. And I think what happened for me was I love to read. And so I met enough people along the way, white and black, who, you know, I don't want to say, because there's no such thing as transcending race. But when you're smart, or when you're perceived as smart, people will suspend their bias because they like how inquisitive or intelligent you are. And so they're like, oh, you're not like those people. And so you get a different kind of experience and treatment. And I feel like I definitely saw that being smart was a privilege, particularly in school. And it was one that I exploited because I really needed freedom and I needed to be able to do what I wanted to do in school. And so I learned pretty early that being smart helped ease the angst of racism and sexism to some degree.
Do you remember what you imagined as a kid when you pictured yourself as a grown-up?
Yes, I do. So I remember like when I first started thinking about what I wanted to be. Well, first of all, I would lay out in my backyard with my sister and we would look for four-leaf clovers. So if that just gives you an idea on the kind of kid I was, and I would...
Give me a sense of your level of patience for this activity, like for a half hour, for all day?
Hours. I would be in the...
Okay, that does give me a sense.
It would be hours. And my sister would kind of come and go. She would like check in on me. Did you find any? You know, then she would run away. She was three years
older. She came in for the clover update.
Yes. But I would find them and I would pick them. And like one time I got rid of all the water in the house, in the refrigerator, and I caught rainwater out of the spout and put it in the refrigerator so we could have fresh water. I used to sunbathe in the backyard. Like, I mean, I was just really... So I was a dreamer and my mother gave me space for that. She never tried to tell me I was weird or take that from me. And that's pretty amazing because she didn't grow up in a kind of like free to express yourself, you know, but I never thought I was weird until later, like in reflection, I'm like, how did you love me? But yeah, I remember thinking I wanted to be a professor. And I wanted to travel internationally and have international lovers. I remember thinking that it like really hit me around the age of 14.
You were like the female protagonist of a James Bond movie?
Yes.
Only intellectual.
Right. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do lectures and research and like meet hot guys at lectures and say, you know, with accents and... They would say something to me and I would be like, yes, that's exactly. And then we would talk some more and then I would go to the next city.
You had a very worldly, cosmopolitan vision.
I did. I just liked meeting people. But then I thought it would be fun to also, like, if once I got grown up, I never thought about...
You wanted to meet them and blow their minds.
Yes. Yes.
So you now are a single mom and I'm curious what that means to you.
Well, it means a lot of things. Some of it's not for radio, but but I will say that I know how it should look based on how I was raised. My mother did an amazing job of always holding space for my father in his coming and going and in his what I felt to my standard was inconsistent. It wasn't to his standard, but it was to my standard. Inconsistent. And I felt like I was watching him show other people more love than he showed me and my sister. But my mother she always held space for him. You know, he was always invited to everything, you know, always when she prepared things, she prepared things for him to take back to his family. Like, so I think that watching someone who, I mean, they didn't, you know, they did not get along, but watching them be divorced and be okay, that was, you know, but I wish that she would have kind of put the hammer on him a little bit more. And I think she did. I know she did behind closed doors, but I think I would have liked to see her like curse him out a few times in person. She never did that though.
You know, I want to talk to you more about being a writer, but I do want to get into like this bigger picture of your personal life just a little bit, because as you were just coming out of a divorce, you also suffered a really profound loss, the loss of your sister.
Yes. And I was in the divorce, you know, and I was leaning heavily. She's my older sister and 3 years older, but really kind of like 30 years older because she's a Capricorn and hence very bossy. And she still bosses me around. She still definitely is bossy. But so what happened with my sister is that I never... ever thought that she would leave. I don't know what it was. I just thought we were going to grow old together as sisters. I thought I was going to always be able to lean on her. And, you know, we had...
We think that about our siblings.
We do.
I think we all do.
We really do. And I just felt like half of my life went away because she was the one who called the divorce, right? She told me one day, she said, you and your husband at the time need to get it together or get gone. And she was like, it's not fair. You all are going to raise miserable children if you continue this facade. I don't think anybody else saw it but her. You know, she was the one who called it first. And so I felt like when I lost her, I felt like, one, I lost half my memory because she would always remember things about our childhood that I would forget because she was 3 years older. Or she would remind me of a perspective or detail that I missed. And so I feel like my childhood got cut in half, you know, when she was gone. And then when I went away to college, she was still here. And so she would remind me of things that happened while I was away. And I lost all of those details, but I also lost one of my best friends, and my nephew lost his mother and his best friend. She was incredibly close to my nephew, and I don't think that he has really recovered, you know, from that. And as much as my mom and I have tried to be there, there is nothing that replaces such a sacred relationship as that. And so I always say I never mourned my marriage ending because I had her to mourn, you know. It was such a sad loss and it was so unexpected and she was young and
it sounds like a really very random accident.
It was thing. It was a very random accident. She broke her ankle and 6 days later she was dead. That was it. And it was, you know, and we thought it was just, yeah. And so it, you know, and it, when you think about this idea, I remember looking at my grandmothers and my mother on the front row and looking at my sister in the casket. And I was like, how is this even real? How are my grandmothers and my mother looking at my sister? It just was a mind trip, you know, but I've made peace with it. I mean, it's been almost 15 years. I really feel and believe deeply in holding ancestral spaces in my home. And so she's just right there. I just feel like she's in the other room. And I have a piece that is beyond any understanding that I felt that I would ever get to in that day.
You know, you and your mom seem to be such a tight unit. And it's clear you've been through a real journey together.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And my mother and my sister and I were all that tight together. And my daughter is literally, she's so much like my sister. I mean, her appearance, the way she laughs, her lips, her hands, her color, the way she crosses her legs. And sometimes I'll look at her and she'll say, Mom, I already know what you're going to say. Like, she knows the look when I'm like, you look like, you know, you look like your Auntie Lala. And you know, she was only 2 when she passed away. But we have videos and pictures and we still tell stories. So...
We have to take one more break, but we will get right back to what creativity and the life of the mind mean to Natasha Elskari, author of Mama Sutra, just out now. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Natasha Elskari. She's the author of a new book and a regular commentator here on Central Standard. She joins us to talk about race, gender, pop culture, literature, quite often... all of those things put together. We have talked about Janelle Monáe. We've talked about Toni Morrison. But today we are talking about Natasha, and that is a real honor for me. Hi again, Natasha.
Hi, Gina. It's great to be here with you.
It's great to be here with you, too. And I am curious to get back to your writing. What or who inspired you to become a writer?
I had wonderful teachers, those same teachers that I talked about earlier who saw a gift in me.
Pushed you hard, yeah.
And they encouraged me to continue to write. But the love of writing came from a very deep personal place. And my mother provided me with time, space, and materials. So that also encouraged me. I spent a lot of time in the public library. that was also a place I could meet my boyfriend and my mother wouldn't be mad at me. I had a lot of library dates growing up. And
this might have contributed to your vision of being an international professor.
Yes.
With,
because you could kiss between the stacks, you know, back then, because that, like, people weren't hanging out in the library the way they do now. It's so cool. I wish libraries were that the way they are now. I wish they were like that then, because
they're very active now.
Yeah. And you can, like, drink water at the library. You couldn't even do that back then. You couldn't drink. You couldn't have a snack. And I used to sneak all those things in. So I think that I love the action of writing. I had all these amazing pens and post-its and notebooks and stationery. I always had those things. My mother always made sure I had that. And that gave me a sense of personal, like, this is a relationship I'm having with the art.
Why do you think you write? I know that's a big question, but I think the answer is different for everybody.
Yeah, and for me, it's different every day. So sometimes I write because I feel like something needs to be heard. Sometimes I'm writing because I actually enjoy the feeling that I get when I'm typing or physically writing. And I first became familiar with that because I journal. And so the idea of just free thought or moving across the page or just the action of writing, the sound of the pen, the feel of the ink, the hold of the pen. I enjoy the physicality of writing and typing. Of watching page
maybe
in, numbers
as opposed
grow.
To just thinking by itself.
Yeah, no, thinking too. Like I realize I have a lot of characters in my head. Some of those characters are me, but I have a lot of things that want to come out that aren't me, and I'm like, oh, I need to get this out. Or if I hear something over and over in my head, I jot it down, and I'm like, okay, I need to go back to this. So I start a lot of things. But this is the time now. And I think that's also writing as a mother. So sometimes I would only be able to get down certain things, between practices and stoplights and stuff like that, being stuck in traffic, going to rehearsals and all that stuff. And then, it just calls me, it's such an intimacy that calls me. And it's a thing that I feel the most romantic about, you know, is writing. I just feel like I love it so much.
Do you have had quite an academic journey, and you've landed as an educator and writer, but you've mentioned that you've envisioned yourself as this traveling professor. Are you able to articulate what it is about writing that satisfies something that those other ideas you used to have maybe weren't quite going to?
Right. Well, I think that writing satisfies my grappling with the human nature. And to try to create a voice or an understanding for something that really people aren't paying attention to, or they don't know what to say about it. You know, that's the thing. Like, I don't write as soon as something happens. I just can't. I am still grappling with it. And so I believe strongly in writing the lives of ordinary Black women, because I think that they are extraordinary. And that is where my work mostly lives. I don't try to write characters I don't know in my fiction. So I have two more books coming out this year. And one is my first novel. And the other one is poems written about a decade in my grandmother's life. And it's all written in dialect. So I just feel such a sense of wanting to tell the stories of Black women who maybe don't want to tell those stories themselves or can't, but to give the type of attention that I feel like it deserves and to give the focus. You know, it's like the difference between when people sell art on the street and that piece gets to be in a gallery. That's how I feel like it is what it means to put out a book, is that it gives it the proper space for people to properly appreciate and to experience it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the decade in your grandmother's life that has captured your creative spirit?
Yeah, so I was working on a book. I'm still working on it, called Still Life, and it's supposed to be four generations of feminism. And I've been working on it for like 10 years, and I realized that I needed to do that because my daughter's voice is developing. And so it carries in that time and to the time we are now. And getting her permission was very hard pressed. But I had these poems written in my maternal grandmother's voice, my mother's mother, but they weren't fitting with the collection. And so someone said to me, maybe they need to be their own work. And I was like, oh, I didn't even think of that. And I had about 16 of these poems. And so I was like, well, 20 poems would make it a chapbook. And they are real stories and imagined stories. But the one of the things about the African-American community, and then even like just talking about it in Mama Sutra, is the idea that our mothers are just people who gave birth to us, but not that they're whole people and whole lovers. And so I thought, what would it be like to go back and think about my grandmother's life and the stories that she told me? When I would go there, I would go and visit my grandparents for spring break. So while everybody else was out like kicking it at Freaknik, I was like, I'm going to my grandmother's and my grandfather's, and they live in the country. I needed that one from school, but I also needed to be nurtured by them. And I got to do that alone. And I would travel and take my little dictaphone and, you know.
When you were how old?
I was in college. So I was 18, 19, 20, 21. And then I would record history. But my grandmother had an interesting decade because she was married and had 5 children, and she left her husband who was abusive, and then she married my grandfather about a decade later, and that was how my mother was born. And so it's kind of a real, parts of it is real, but others imagine decade of what it was like with my grandmother dating. Which is very hard for some people to imagine, you know, but it's not for me, because I remember like my grandmother would let us watch her get dressed, and you know what I mean? And I just was like, she's so pretty. She's so beautiful.
Yeah, she's a person.
She's a person. And she wouldn't tell me parts of her life until after I was married, like when she found out I was getting married, because I was still in college. And she was like, okay, I can tell you these stories. You're a woman now. But before that, she wouldn't tell me. I was just annoying. And then but it was something about, you're going to become a wife, so I can tell you these things. So I feel like that was about judgment, and that was about me having to earn. And for her, being a wife meant that you earned the right to those stories that maybe you wouldn't have known what to do with them if you hadn't been in my shoes, kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm really happy and excited about that collection. It's called I Say, He Say, and it is written in dialect.
And this is part of a larger project, it sounds like, with the voices of your family.
Oh, I guess so. Like, I don't know, because the book is fiction. Like, the novel that I wrote is fiction. There are autobiographical moments, but it really, the main character is definitely not me. So I feel like it is always, I'm inspired by those things. I'm inspired by the lives of the women around me, by the Black women around me, and I'm inspired by Black women. Lives and how they navigate their feminism and how they navigate their freedom.
There's a word that you've used several times that I think you might define differently than other people, and I'm curious about your definition of it. The word lover, because you've talked about that we haven't imagined our grandmothers as lovers, or that we, you know, we haven't imagined our mothers as lovers. And I think that that means something more than just a literal, like, that coupling or something.
Right. I do use it like multiple definitions. So when I say that I am a lover, I mean that I am just one who deeply loves, who expresses love. You know, I am an intimate person. That is who I am. And then I can have lovers, and those lovers are people that I'm actually having awesome and fantastic and great sex with. So I think I mean it on a humanity, a social level, but also on an intimate level. So when I say we can't imagine our grandmothers as lovers, I do mean the actual intimate, like these are the women who not only birthed our parents, but they also enjoyed sex.
Our time is up. Natasha Elskari, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a portrait session. That means Natasha's story will be up on our website, along with photographs from throughout her life. We'll have that for you over the weekend. Follow KCUR on Twitter or Facebook if you want that to pop up on your feed, or just go to kcur.org or kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where you'll find audio from this conversation by the end of the day. That's it for this week. If you missed yesterday's conversation with Frances Lamb of The Splendid Table, check that out. It was great. KCUR.org/Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Ann Kniggendorf, Noah Taborda, and Aviva Okeson-Haberman. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. And our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.